Hi, I'm Don Genova, and you're listening to a podcast recorded in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, called All You Can Eat. Big news first, All You Can Eat has been nominated for a James Beard Foundation Broadcast Media Award. This is my third nomination. The first two were for my syndicated documentary series called Food for Thought, which is heard on CBC radio stations in Canada. This is the first year the Beard Foundation is recognizing excellence in webcasts about food. I submitted Volume 2 of All You Can Eat to the awards committee, which featured an in-depth interview with Anthony Bourdain when he was touring Vancouver, and a documentary from my archives that profiled Canadian chef James Barber, who has always been an inspiration to me on the occasion of the re-release of a series of his earlier cookbooks. You can check it out, Volume 2 of All You Can Eat. The award ceremony takes place in New York City on May 8th, so I'm trying to figure out if I can juggle my schedule to get there, and my budget as well. Be fun to attend, and I might get a chance to meet some of my colleagues at the brand new Culinary Podcast Network. Congratulations to Chef Mark of the Remarkable Palate podcast for being the chief cook and bottle washer and putting the network together, which sounds something like this.
Tune in to the Culinary Podcast Network, where food and passion are always in fashion. Find us on iTunes or at culinarypodcastnetwork.com.
So be sure to check out culinarypodcastnetwork.com to see who else is on the network and listen to their latest shows. Now on to today's program material. First up, some forbidden fruit. I like to think I'm an adventurous eater. My motto used to be, I'll try anything once. Then I met a guy named Jerry Hopkins, who used to write for Rolling Stone magazine. He wrote a book called Strange Foods. In between tales of cobra wine and fried grasshoppers, he told me his motto was, I'll try anything twice. Jerry said he tasted strange foods twice just to make sure he really didn't like them. I thought that was good advice, so now I try things twice. Then I started reading a book called The Devil's Picnic, Around the World in Pursuit of Forbidden Fruit, by Montreal-based writer Taras Gresko. Here was someone else I could admire, as I read about his efforts to find and experience some of the world's banned foodstuffs, beverages, and stimulants. In Vancouver, we headed to a specialty cheese shop to chat first about illicit cheese.
The book's called The Devil's Picnic, and it's all about sort of the demonization of foods, and one cheese in particular was demonized back in 1999. There were articles all over the world, the Wall Street Journal, talking about this cheese, époisse, which is a raw milk cheese. And it was said to have caused a woman's death and seriously harmed two other people. So all of a sudden there was all of this press saying, you know, the cheese that kills, and why are these like stinky French people with their Galois dripping into the curds still being allowed to ship their cheeses over to the United States? So raw milk cheeses that are aged for less than 60 days were promptly banned. And this has even been strengthened by the Bioterrorism Act of 2003 in the United States. I went for the book to the farmhouses and the factories where this cheese is made, and they're impeccable. I mean, even the small farms are now run like microchip labs. I mean, they are obviously in farms, but they follow these HACCP norms, which were established by NASA in 1959. I was really impressed. I mean, the EU, as its regulations have actually killed off a lot of small farmhouse producers, which I find a tragedy. But what I find more tragic is the kind of demonization of what's actually a very safe product, raw milk cheese. I mean, when I went to this little farmhouse in this village near Époisse in Burgundy in France, the woman, the cheesemaker's wife, was, you know, 3 or 4 months pregnant, and she was drinking raw milk every day. Just goes to show there are different standards, different things all over the world, that are considered kosher, so to speak.
Do you find that in North America we've become so sanitized that we're losing our ability to stand these bugs that are out there?
I don't know if that's true. I think we think that that's true. But maybe that's certainly what the French cheesemakers said. And it's not a great policy to eat only sort of irradiated processed food all the time. You have to challenge your immune system from time to time and your palate, frankly. That's what part of being alive is all about. And, you know, I don't want to eat, like, reheated airplane food all the time. That's, you know, the stuff that's safe but has no flavor. I mean, you're going to have a life that has no flavor either. Thanks.
I loved reading your chapter about Spain and searching for the bull's testicles, and which took you a long time to actually not find in the end of it.
Yeah.
It's something to be said, and it's something that I learned when I went to Spain for the first time. I looked at my guidebook, and it says, pick a place that has lots of garbage on the floor, because that's the best place to go to, and it sounds like it's still that way now.
Yeah, I just wonder if there's going to be cigarette butts on the floor still, because technically they outlawed smoking as well as a siesta in Spain on January 1st. Now, I think the Spanish, like the French, tend to find a way around these laws. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of smoking and compost, cigarette butts, they call it compost, on the floor still in Spain.
How did you figure out which kind of substances you wanted to track down in your travels?
I chose things that you could put into your body. I chose things that people could imagine eating, smoking, drinking themselves. So things like absinthe in Switzerland. I went to a little valley in the Jura, I went to the French side and the Swiss side, where they've been, in the Swiss side, they've been making it in sort of underground stills for 200 years. And there's still this sort of culture of moonshining, basically. I chose things that had been demonized for a variety of different reasons. Chocolate, for example, in the town of Bayonne in France, was briefly banned, and I wanted to find out why. Turns out it was a convoluted story about sort of a local conspiracy of a Catholic guild against the Jewish chocolate makers. So they banned Jewish chocolate making, essentially. It was a tradition that had been brought from Spain to the south of France. Everywhere I looked, there was some kind of sort of base motive for these prohibitions. We're told that, you know, things are prohibited for our own good, but too often it's like a question of, it's a tool of power, you know, and it's someone trying to impose his or her will or gain power over somebody else. And frankly, I think we're often good arbiters of what we can eat. On the other hand, I'm glad that certain standards are in place. I'm not against the inspection of you know, seafood, and I'm not for a totally free market and these kind of things. Things like HACCP norms are necessary, especially if you're sending cheeses long distances.
But it seems like if you ban something, the more people will want it.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's the forbidden fruit effect, and that's what I was exploring in the book, too. I mean, I talk about coca leaves in Bolivia. And coca leaves are part of Bolivian culture. People drink the tea. It's called mate de coca every morning, or they chew them throughout the day. And even the middle-class Argentinians in neighboring Argentina will chew it, like doctors, just as a little pick-me-up. On the other hand, it's been sort of distilled into its more potent form, and it's very much the whole people in the United States are actually arrested if they are, you know, Latin Americans, if they've had a cup of mate de coca and they prove positive on a drug test because of it. Yeah, I mean, there is this culture of demonization of things, and it's really unfortunate.
What was the kind of grossest thing that you experienced when you were doing this?
Well, the whole the Spanish seem to have this love of extreme food. You can go to the markets there and you'll find like blocks of coagulated blood in the markets, which they use to start sauces and things like that. And I'm omnivorous when I travel. I'm very curious about new experiences, but on a day-to-day basis, I kind of limit my protein intake to seafood, and I'm a little suspicious of North American meat, to tell you the truth, because it's so, I don't know, I mean, you can buy organic meat, but that's costly, and in my regular diet, I kind of stick to seafood. So the grossest thing I ate was, and the hardest thing for me was my sort of diet to switch over to a completely carnivorous diet while I was in Madrid, eating offal, eating innards, things like zarajos, which are deep-fried lamb's intestines on a little piece of vine, and you know, so it's the intestines are wrapped around it and then deep-fried, and they're served with a little hunk of lemon. Fortunately, I was drinking a lot of Rioja wine at the time, so I was able to get it down. But that was a challenge. And I guess in that chapter of the book where I was looking for criadillas, or bull's testicles, eating a plate of criadillas only to find out that they were criadillas de cerdo, pig's testicles. That was a little rough on my system, too. But I enjoyed it.
So you were prepared to eat the bull's testicles, but somehow when they became pig's testicles, it did a flip in your brain?
Oh, yes, bull's testicles make you strong. I don't know. I didn't feel mass macho after eating after the pig's balls.
It's often said that in North America, we eat to live, but in Europe especially, they live to eat. And do you find that in the food cultures of those countries you visited, in Europe especially, that really is true?
They live to eat. Yes, they do. There's kind of this horror of food in North America and suspicion of it. I think it's really strong in on the West Coast. We have a sort of... Now I live in Montreal, and believe me, the people that in Montreal live to eat. Weekends start on Thursday, et cetera, et cetera. Everything you've heard about joie de vivre and all that is true. It's funny, on the West Coast and a lot of big American cities, there's this kind of attitude towards food as fuel, something that you choke down, grudgingly. But and of course, there's the sort of like upper bourgeois idea of food is, you know, you have to have a good understanding of like of fine wines and fine cheeses, that kind of thing. That's part of being a man of the world. But I don't know if we enjoy it all that much. I mean, that's what I noticed in Europe, and that's why I love traveling in Europe and also Asia, lots of other places. People really structure their day around the meals that they're going to eat and the socializing that they're going to do around the meals. And a lot of people have talked about places like San Sebastian, for example, which I visited, where they have these tapas bars, and people have this tradition of there are 100 tapas bars, or pinchos bars, as they call them, in a 10 blocks radius. And it's like foodie heaven. Every bar has its own little specialty. You can get everything from sea urchins to I wish I could find some criadillas there, but you can find lots of different things there. Or there's bars that specialize in anchovies prepared 100 different ways. And the way that people socialize is they go out on poteos. In other parts of Spain, they're called tapeos. And they'll have a little glass of wine, a little glass of manzanilla, along with their favorite food, and they'll go out with a group of friends. And this happens in San Sebastian. And no one really gets too drunk. It's not like, the binge drinking that you see in Northern Europe. And it's about the food. It's about the socializing. It's about being with a group of friends. I like that. I like that that kind of attitude towards to food that you encounter in these Southern European countries. And, yeah, living to eat can be a rewarding way to live, believe me. We kind of fetishize food here a little too much. I like the down-to-earth attitude that people have to food in those places, too. There's a real connection to the farms and the land.
You're working on another book right now. Tell me about that.
It's tentatively called Bottom Feeder, and it's all about vanishing seafood around the world. The fact that our oceans are being sucked dry at an alarming rate, and we're starting to rely on farmed salmon and farmed shrimp. I just got back from India, where I saw some really shocking things happening in the name of creating shrimp farms to supply us with our, with our butterfly prawns and all that. I think I had this realization while I was writing this book. I ate a plate of angulas, which are baby eels, in a restaurant in Madrid. And there were hundreds of these little things staring back at me. It was like spaghetti with eyes, staring back at me kind of accusingly. It's like a luxury dish in Spain. Because they're becoming more and more rare, it costs an enormous amount. Like the plate, which is 100 grams I had, costs 51 euros.
And that's a lot of money.
That was a lot of money. It cost 850 euros a kilogram in the fish store, store around Christmas time. And, I mean, and then I started realizing, you know what, I started doing research afterwards, and, like, the freshwater eels aren't coming back to the rivers of Spain, which is the reason the prices are rising. And it started to get me thinking about the fact that we're draining our oceans and polluting our lakes pretty quickly. And, you know, I want my children, when I have children, my grandchildren, to be able to eat good tuna, you know, and discover the fact that there's tuna that doesn't just come out of a can, but there's fantastic yellowfin and stuff like that. I mean, I do like eating these things, and I think we're at a turning point in the world where we're really industrial fishing is about to destroy the oceans. We've got to be careful.
I think a lot of experts are saying it's almost too late already, and we are going to be eating a lot more farmed fish in the future, and that's the only way we're going to be able to eat our fish.
But there's ways of bringing this to the public consciousness. There are ways of regulating things, and the research in the Devil's Pick taught me that free markets, which are the sort of this libertarian dream, are disastrous. They end up destroying natural resources. And we from the bison in North America, the passenger pigeon, and now we're seeing, like, the last examples of bluefin tuna disappearing from the ocean in the name of, you know, greed. We almost eliminated the whales, but the Japanese are still eating whale meat in specialized restaurants. So there's this sort of hyper-fetishization of food, too, where people will boast about eating the rare. And I realized that I was participating in this to a certain extent when I saw those little eels staring back at me.
Okay, when can we expect to see that book coming out?
It's going to be released here in Canada probably in 2008. And I hope there'll still be some fish left in the sea by then, and I'm sure there will be.
Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
That was Taras Gresko, author of The Devil's Picnic, published by HarperCollins. The thing I like about The Devil's Picnic is that it isn't just a travelogue of Taras Gresko's experiences. It's very well researched with plenty of information to help us understand how the substances in his book came to be banned or outlawed. Now, thanks to the folks at HarperCollins, I have 3 copies of The Devil's Picnic to give away, but you have to work for your meal. For your chance to win, go to my website, pacificpalate.com, click on the link for the contest page, and tell me about the strangest thing you've ever eaten. I think for me so far, even though I've eaten chocolate-covered ants and dried mealworms, the strangest thing was a cup of live, tiny fish doused with soy sauce on my only trip to Japan. It's just one step further than sushi, I suppose. Deadline to enter the contest is March 31st. You're listening to All You Can Eat, part of the Culinary Podcast Network. I'm Don Genova. In Eastern Canada, the maple syrup season is in full swing, so I think it's timely to revisit a piece from my Food for Thought archives with a visit to a maple syrup festival at a farm near Peterborough, Ontario. It's a bright, sunny Saturday morning at Kennedy's Sugar Bush in Millbrook, Ontario. The annual maple syrup festival is in full swing. Farmhands feed a roaring fire under the evaporator, where the maple sap is being boiled down into maple syrup. It takes 40 liters of sap to make 1 liter of syrup. Next to the sugar shack housing the evaporator, children and adults alike are gobbling down sticks coated in taffy, made from pouring hot, thick syrup into a trough loaded with fresh snow. What do you think of that?
Well, it's excellent. Very good.
Is that your first or second?
Second.
Can I ask you what you think of your taffy there?
It's delicious.
I know you got your mouth full.
I know. So far, it's delicious.
Now, do you try to do this every year?
I've never been here before.
Never been here before. What do you think?
I think I'm going to sugar crash in about 14 minutes, but I think it's pretty great.
But this is something you've done many times before.
Lots of times. I love this. This is one of my favorite times of the year.
Judging from the people crowded around the taffy, everyone likes the taste. That makes Peter Danielson happy. He and his wife, Connie, operate Kennedy's Sugar Bush, a real family tradition.
This is my daughter, Anna, and she's 4.5. She's also very tired because she's been fighting a cold. And she is the 6th generation of Kennedy to be, pardon me, the 7th. I'm the 6th. She's the 7th. So we moved here from Ireland in 1840 and began farming. They probably made syrup at that time. And then commercially, we can trace it back to the late 1800s when they were selling it with records that we have on the farm. And so it supplemented the farm income for a long time. We do other things, but the maple syrup is probably the biggest income in selling the maple syrup and the supplies. We also have an agency for a company in Quebec that makes the supplies.
This farm employs modern methodology to produce the syrup, but sometimes the old ways of gathering the syrup from the drip buckets on the trees are the best ways.
Well, it's funny, they've changed back to horses. My dad used tractors and for the few buckets that he had, and since I began tapping a little different bush, I've gone back to a few more buckets as we go here and there to get the buckets. We've gone back to horses.
Peter's newest piece of equipment cost him a lot of money, but it saves him a lot of time. He puts the raw sap through a reverse osmosis filter to remove some of the water content.
The reverse osmosis just squeezes the sap through a membrane, and it takes out about half of the water. So it starts out coming in around 3% sugar, and we're going to squeeze it, and through the membrane, half the water goes out. This is just going to make my life a little easier. It's also noisy, so it gets its own little cabinet, so I can close it in and let it work away like a robot.
The filter means the sap needs to be boiled half as long as before, saving time and fuel. Once Peter has the filter going, he moves quickly back and forth between the evaporator and a final filter station, the last stage before the syrup is bottled. There usually isn't this much work to do while the festival is on, but this year Mother Nature wasn't cooperating.
It's been hectic. Like, we didn't get any sap when it warmed up because it warmed up very quickly, so it went from very cold to very warm. It went too warm, so we didn't get frost at night, and the sap, we had a little run, and then it stopped. And then we got cold, and it stopped again. And, of course, now we're into the cold nights and warm days, and it's perfect.
Along with the maple taffy on snow, the festival offered tastes of syrup, horse and wagon rides into the bush, music, food, and blacksmith demonstrations. Sales of the various grades of maple syrup and related products were brisk.
5 and 5 is 10.
Thank you.
Are you keeping busy today?
It's been really good. It's been very steady all morning.
What seems to be the favorite thing that people buy?
You know what's interesting is most years I find we sell a lot of light and medium. This year a lot more amber is being sold. So it's varied. And people want small right through to the big 4 liters. So there's been a variety of things. Always a lot of sugar.
Yeah.
The kids always like lots of sugar.
Peter Danielson's wife Connie made sure it all went smoothly.
When it works and it runs well, it's a very rewarding job because so you get to be outside, you get to work with nature, we make a natural product, and you see the results of conservation in practice, because if my husband's father and grandfather hadn't looked after the trees and the bush, then we wouldn't have been doing what we did today. So it's I'd like being part of a sustainable production like this. It makes me feel better.
If it makes Connie feel good, it makes me feel great. I came home with a 4-liter jug of syrup, and I pour it on everything from porridge to fruit salads. It also makes a great marinade for barbecued salmon mixed with a little bit of soy sauce. Maple syrup can get moldy, so refrigerate it once you've opened it, and the syrup can be frozen for longer storage. Get some more ideas by visiting OntarioMaple.com. That's Food for Thought. I'm Don Genova. Gotta love that maple syrup. If you go to PacificPalette.com, you'll find 3 or 4 great maple syrup recipes I've made recently, including that salmon marinated in maple syrup and soy sauce, then grilled on a cedar plank. That brings us to the end of Volume 18 of All You Can Eat. If you visit my website, please take a moment to fill out the advertising survey you'll see, and stay tuned for some great material in the future, including a podcast about the science of chocolate, and a report from the International Association of Culinary Professionals Convention taking place in Seattle at the end of the week. I'm Don Genova. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.